Welcome to webinar number 6, Grounding Skills Before, During, and After an Incident. This is Françoise Mathieu, and I hope that you've enjoyed the past 5 webinars. Today we're going to talk about something that in our company at TEND we are frequently asked to provide training on this topic, and I want to explain a little bit of the context of when and how we're asked to do this and what we've learned along the way in terms of providing some skills to kind of, the way to think about grounding skills is how do we reset? How do we return ourselves to a healthy baseline after an upsetting event has happened, or perhaps we've been exposed to some difficult content? And there are a variety of ways in which this can happen. An example I could give you is in the fall, we were asked to provide some training for folks who were going into the courtrooms. And they were going to be dealing with some very difficult court cases with some difficult material. And the attorneys who were involved, as well as the court reporters and pretty much everyone in the courtroom, were interested in some resources to try and manage, you know, what is it like when you inevitably have to hear or see some difficult images, for example, or hear some difficult stories. And we were able to pull into a whole bunch of research that has been around for a while in terms of managing trauma exposure and modify it to be relevant to the variety of workplaces that we kind of are involved in, some of them being, as I said, the judicial system, working with folks who work with children in a variety of settings, and in this instance, talking about how do we prepare and manage and process when we are exposed to a difficult event. Now, when I use the term incident, I'm using that deliberately in a kind of a vague way because it really depends on a variety of factors. You know, whether this event is going to be upsetting to you or not will depend on your amount of experience. So maybe if you've dealt with a lot of those types of events in the past, so an example I could give you is, as I'm sure you can understand, as a crisis counselor, the first few times that I had to deal with a very suicidal student were incredibly stressful events for me, and of course they never got easy, but at the beginning I did not have a vast amount of training or resources to deal with those, and they made me, of course, extremely anxious, but also made me quite conscientious to make sure that I was not missing anything and I was doing the right thing. At some point, I never became, of course, desensitized to those events, but at some point those events were less stressful to me than they would have been in the past simply because I had a repertoire, I have kind of a set of resources that I knew how to tap into those in order to process what was going on. The reality, though, as many of you have indicated, is that the nature of the school and the students that are in the schools have become not only increasingly complex, but also the sheer volume has increased. And we've seen that actually in other work environments as well. I've worked in women's shelter environments for many years, and in the women's shelter and transitional housing environments, a lot of shelter workers say that the type of clients and residents who come to stay in the shelters often have more complex mental health issues than they used to have in the past. There are some substance use challenges, and some of the shelter workers who had been around for a long time said that they were not necessarily trained or prepared to deal with the really complex sets of problems that they were being exposed to, but also that they had not necessarily been given the tools to manage just the sheer number of folks coming in and needing some specific assistance and having maybe some very strong emotional and physical reactions, and their circumstances, of course, where those things can become really quite dangerous or heated or just emotionally very disruptive. So when we are referring to grounding skills, we're talking about being able to prepare ourselves when we know we're going into a heated or a difficult situation. Sometimes we know ahead of time, sometimes we don't. How do we deal with them as they're happening, and how do we process after an event? On top of the debriefing that I mentioned last time, I wanted to talk about some different strategies that have been found to be really useful. Some of these resources are coming from colleagues of mine who have been working in really complex work environments, whether that's at the emergency ward, assisting people who are going to testify in court, and really providing support for folks who are going through some very difficult traumatic events and sometimes, you know, share some pretty difficult stories with us. And so that's kind of the source of the research that, that we've been gathering is coming from that kind of environment as well. So if we go back to the balance map that I had presented to you a couple of webinars ago, and as I was mentioning, there are kind of nine elements, and one of them I refer to as trauma stewardship. So what does that mean? I have a dear colleague of mine, her name is Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, and she's a social worker based in Seattle. And Laura has been doing pretty complex trauma work for a very long time. For a time, she worked in a hospital emergency ward, and as a social worker, she saw everything you can imagine in a very big, complex city in the United States. She would be involved in, you know, post-shooting events. She was involved in evacuations, you know, in medevac, helicopter. I mean, lots of really complex things. And as a result of her work in social work, Laura produced a wonderful book called Trauma Stewardship, which I highly recommend. And in fact, Laura is publishing a new book in June with the wonderful title Overwhelmed, where she will start talking about this exact topic we're discussing today. How do we manage when the demand and the complexity outweighs what we have in terms of our own training and capacity and resources? So I borrowed the term trauma stewardship from Laura. And what Laura was kind of referring to is, what are all the different ways in which we individually can learn to manage processing these difficult stories and incidents that, you know, sometimes inevitably we are exposed to? So the first piece is kind of thinking about managing the amount of exposure that we have. Now, in our schools, we may not have control over that at all, but there are other parts in our life where we do have a certain amount of control to the amount of what I call trauma inputs are coming our way. And the reason I'm kind of using this little gizmo on the slide that you see, that's a Geiger counter. And a Geiger counter is something that radiology technicians use. You may, if you've ever had to have an x-ray, you may have seen that radiology techs have this kind of little thing they stick in their pocket. It doesn't always look like that, but it's kind of like this. It looks almost like the size of a credit card, and they carry it on them. And what that is a very small device that's designed to monitor and measure how much exposure to radiation they have so that we can make sure that, obviously, they're not exposed to too much radiation and that they are safe. So obviously in our jobs, we don't have a Geiger counter. There's no way for us to measure, I've been exposed to too much trauma today, I've been exposed to too many difficult stories. There is no such a thing. And so what we need to do is we need to develop our own techniques to be able to kind of assess how we're doing. And the first place that I recommend begins at home. And so when I talk about managing your trauma inputs, I'm not suggesting that we necessarily have control over what life brings us in terms of our own personal experiences or life or the community we live in. I mean, some of those things are not within our control. But I do think, respectfully, that all of us do have a certain amount of control over what we consume in terms of media. So one of the things that I recommend for all of us, and I believe that some of you have already told us that you do this already, is if you are doing a high-stress job all day, it may not be such a good idea to also watch highly charged, highly stressful, sometimes traumatic content in the evening. I remember at some point when I was doing a lot of work with soldiers who had been, for example, in Iraq, and this was during one of the conflicts between the United States and Iraq, and I would come home, and my partner, who does not work in this field, would very innocently be watching the news on television. And I remember at some point saying to him, you know, do you mind, can we turn the TV off? Because I know you want to stay on top of the news, but I lived the news today. I spent my whole day hearing about the war. And if I come home and I watch another two-hour show showing exactly the same stories and events, I never get to decompress. I'm always in a state of hyper-awareness or vigilance or kind of elevated level of stress. I've certainly found, and I'm sure you have too, because there's been so many really pretty shocking events that have happened in the news in the recent, even if you just look back to the last few months. And I'm not suggesting that you not stay informed about what's going on, but But there is a difference between seeing, you know, a news feed on television and then leaning into it to the point where we're on our devices and we're watching YouTube videos of the terrible thing that just happened in some other city. You know, there's been a lot more sharing of those graphic videos, if you want to look at some elements of violence, where you could, quite frankly, spend hours watching a huge amount of pretty graphic detail around these issues. I wrote about this a couple of years ago when a very tragic event happened that some of you will remember, and it was the Ottawa shooting. And I remember watching some of it as it was unfolding. It was kind of an accident that I was watching it. My son, I think, just had the sports on, and it was kind of like breaking news. And it was really interesting to me that very quickly after, they were literally kind of, you know, filming this almost live, very quickly the media started shielding some of the graphic nature of what was being shown. And I appreciated that we don't necessarily need to see every single bit of what's happening. But that's happening less and less, and I found that media is a lot more graphic, and you can quite literally go on TV or on your device and watch, you know, incredibly gruesome information. And this is news. So in addition to that, you know, what do you consume in terms of for your leisure activity, the books that you read, the videos and the movies that you watch, the TV shows that you watch? If you're doing, as you are, a very stressful job with some elements of trauma exposure, does it make sense to watch more of that kind of stuff when you come home at night? I mentioned a couple of episodes ago that I have a colleague who's in the correctional service, and she confessed that she'll go home and she'll watch Law and Order Special Victims Unit, even though that's what she did all day. I'm not judging, and maybe for some of you it doesn't bother you at all, and I have had friends who said to me, well, nothing else interests me. But just an invitation to reflect on that. What is it that, think about it, you have one nervous system. What is it that you are doing in terms of allowing it to get a bit of a break? And, you know, the truth is also the opposite, that I certainly have met a lot of people who say to me, the only thing I can watch at night are cooking shows or Home and Garden or whatever, wrestling, something. And so just an invitation to think about, what are your trauma inputs? And, you know, if you read books or magazines, are they also about difficult stories? And it's not about having blinders on. I don't think that you can work in education and have blinders on, because it's day-to-day, you're exposed to it all the time. But what are some ways that you can allow yourself to refuel? So the way we kind of think about managing exposure, we kind of break it down, and this is my colleague Diana, who does a lot of this work, who basically talks about how do we manage before, during, and after exposure to something. Now, as I mentioned, there are times where we can't prepare beforehand because we don't know the event is about to happen, but there are other times where we do know there's something going on, we're about to walk into that situation. What are some of the preparation activities that we can, they're very quick, by the way, that we can develop? What can we do as it's happening, and what can we do after exposure to kind of reprocess what's been going on? So I really love this cartoon. If you see it, there's these two guys or people wearing hazmat suits, and one of them is wearing fluffy bunny slippers, and he says, or she says, this is for emotional protection. So it's kind of a cute image, but it is true that there are ways in which we can kind of get engaged and involved in what's happening in front of us without getting completely lost in the story. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that in a minute. The second kind of, and you're going to see some of the strategies, of course, overlap. You can use them in both or all three instances. But there are ways that we can manage exposure as it's happening. So we are a witness to, or there's an event that's happening right now. What are some of the ways that we can kind of ground ourselves while this event is happening? There's some wonderful resources that were developed by Babette Rothschild. And Babette is a social worker who's been involved in lots of work on trauma and the body. So looking at, you know, how do we process and take in exposure to trauma, and how can we also protect ourselves but also, you know, kind of digest and process what's already happened. And this wonderful book called Help for the Helper, Self-Care Strategies for Managing Burnout and Stress, is full of strategies where she uses some pretty basic neuroscience. I'm not an expert in neuroscience, so I appreciated that Babette kind of simplified it for me because I don't know that much about the brain, but I do know some basic things. And I wanted to share with you some examples of strategies that she provides in her book. So I'm going to show you a couple of very simple pictures. These are not traumatic images. They're just very simple images. And I'm going to invite you to kind of really check them out. So here's the first one. Now, not all of us are particularly empathic, like that we can really connect with other folks, you know, in a physical way. But I just want you to take a look at this picture of this cat and wonder whether you can really get into it and kind of almost feel, like, I can almost feel the stretch of that cat. I can almost feel his little claws ruining my carpet. You know, I can really get into this. And I'm going to go back to that in a minute. Here's another picture. And whenever I show this picture of this sleeping puppy in workshops, often, you know, the entire audience will go, oh, and that oh feeling, what's happening in that moment where you're feeling the stretch of the kitten, or you're feeling that like, oh, feeling, or oh, how soft are his little ears, like kind of a softening that happens in you if you experience that. Maybe you hate cats and dogs, it's fine. That is actually caused by what are called mirror neurons. Now, mirror neurons are a very interesting part of our brain, and it's actually something that my husband has studied at some point where he was looking at armchair athletes. So I don't know if you enjoy watching sports, but he was finding that, for example, he's an avid sports fan. He was noticing, for example, that you could sit and watch a game of football or hockey or tennis, and if you're really into it and you know yourself, or if you have a loved one who's really into sports, you might even notice that the armchair quarterback, so to speak, the person sitting in the chair watching it may almost mimic the same movements that the athlete is doing. Check that out next time. And so he certainly has experienced that himself, and it's always very amusing watching him watch sports because he gets really into it because he himself used to play a lot of sports. And you'll see him almost like he's on the edge of a seat and he's moving in the same way. And what they were able to do, and again, I'm simplifying this because I'm not a neuroscientist, but they're able to find that the same parts of the brain that would light up, you know, if you were involved in this sport, well, the same parts of the brain in the armchair quarterback were actually also being activated. An example of that that was, you know, demonstrated in research was, for example, let's pretend there's a little happy little monkey in a lab. We're going to pretend he's a happy monkey. Happy monkey in a lab. The scientist, you know, gets the monkey to reach for a grape, and the monkey's pleasure center lights up, and he goes, oh, yummy, a grape. Then the scientist reaches for a grape, and the little monkey's brain lights up again, thinking, oh, yummy, you're having a grape. So simplified, what we can start thinking about is this is a way of experiencing empathy, right? We're experiencing something that isn't happening to us, and yet we are still having the same kind of reaction inside of our brain and our body. So that makes a lot of sense to me when I think about feeling empathy or compassion. You know, I remember some years ago, my son talked about having an upset stomach or feeling nauseous, and I wasn't even in the same room as him, but because, of course, I'm very close to him, I felt a little bit nauseous too, even though I didn't have the same symptoms. So those are referred to as mirror neurons. And the reason it's important to recognize that is that if you're a particularly connected, empathic person, if you really connect with other people on that physiological basis, which not everyone does, but you know who you are, what Babette recommends is that we do need to find ways to, as she says, put on the brakes. So I do want to still be present. Let's say you're very distressed and you're telling me a difficult story. I do want to be present for you, but I also have to find ways to put on the brakes so that I don't fall into your story. I don't need to re-experience your story in order to have compassion or to be effective in helping you. So these are just examples. There's a million different examples in which we can put on the brakes. But sometimes I remember in one of the offices I had where I was doing a lot of work with the military, I had a tree outside of the window. It wasn't a particularly nice office, and it wasn't even in a very nice part of town. It was kind of like a, you know, urban jungle. But for some reason, there was a tree right outside my window. And sometimes what I would do when a soldier was describing a story that was particularly graphic or difficult is I would be listening, but I would also look outside at the tree as a way to kind of give myself a little bit of a breather, a way for me to remind my brain and myself, this isn't happening to me right now. So for some people, that's evoking a loved creature. For some of us, it's evoking a loved activity. So I have a friend who's an avid runner. And one of the things that she will do when she's engaged in some pretty heated events is also remind herself that of a run that she recently did. That process of remaining present to what's going on right now, but at the same time calling upon something that is comforting or soothing to us, is referred to as dual awareness, dual as in D-U-A-L. Dual awareness is a process whereby I can be present with you, and at the same time, I can be present to something else. And I can give you a very simple example of that, and I invite you to try it out yourself. Right now, as I'm recording this webinar, there's a ceiling fan above me, and so I can feel the cool air, you know, that's falling down from the fan, and I can look outside and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff going on outside. There's recently, a few minutes ago, I saw on the same branch a robin, a blue jay, a cardinal, and a crow. I don't know if they're having a party or something. So I was able to do that and still remain present to what I'm talking to you about, and that's an example of dual awareness. So you can practice that in non-stressful situations. And what we found is, and you've probably found yourself, if you are very calm in crisis events or you've met a colleague who seems to stay very, very calm, often what they're doing is they're practicing these really basic grounding skills, staying present, not losing track of what's happening, and at the same time being able to call upon something that can bring your stress levels down. Now, obviously, this is a very big kind of body of research, and Diana offers a full-day training on it, but I'm just kind of giving you some highlights. After, how do we process and push the reset button? So as I was mentioning in the last webinar on debriefing and grounding or debriefing skills, there are ways in which sometimes we do need to reset so that we can move on to the next student or to go home and be present for the ones who are waiting for us at home. You know, how do we bring ourselves back down? And there's a really easy activity. I'm going to share it with you in the resources on the website, and it's called 5-4-3-2-1. This activity, by the way, is my favorite one, and it was developed a long time ago by someone called Dolan, and it's been used by lots of different people. But it's basically an activity that you can do with on your own. You can also do it if you have a student who's really escalated and you're needing to bring them back down. And all it is, so you can do it on your own. You basically invite yourself to name out loud, if you're not in public or in your head, five things you can see. So right now I could do it, or I could say pencil, name tag, calculator, stamp, you know, whatever. And then four things you can see. They can be the same or different. Three things you can see. Two things you can see. And then one. And then five things you can hear. So those are different sounds. Sometimes those are harder because there's not always a super noisy environment. 3, 2, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then five things you can feel. And what I mean by that are physical sensations such as I can feel the glasses on my nose. I can feel my watch on my wrist. I can feel the chair on my back. I can feel my feet on the ground. And again, inviting you to name 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And what I have found is that this, for me, works better than any breathing exercise. I know that some people find breathing exercises really helpful or mindfulness activities, and I absolutely believe in those. But I find this one really good because it brings me outside of my head. And I've used it when recently I had to do a presentation, and I was quite nervous about it. It was in front of a very large group, and, you know, I wanted to do a good job, and I used this activity. Not long ago, I was driving in a pretty stressful, pretty crazy traffic environment. I was in Los Angeles. There's like 8 lanes of highway. It's just mad. And I got to the airport after driving in that environment, feeling really stressed about it, and what I did is 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, as I got onto the shuttle bus, and I immediately brought myself back down. So invite you to try this out. I will give you the script for that so you can try it out on your own or with other people. I also invite you to learn some basic grounding skills if you don't practice them already. And I know that some folks are not really big fans of yoga or mindfulness, and some people say, ugh, that doesn't work for me. The first thing to remember is, first of all, they don't need to be enjoyable. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who really started the movement of mindfulness-based stress reduction, one of my favorite quotes, he says, oh, you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. And so what's really important about some of these strategies is you do need to try them more than two or three times. You need to try them, I mean, meditation, mindfulness, the recommendation is that you do it every day for 8 weeks before you see, you know, whether it works for you or not. So any of the activities that I recommend, you know, it takes time to try and feel and decide which ones work best for you. This is a picture of the Calgary Police. They've been starting to do some mindfulness and some yoga. And they've found that it's been tremendously helpful in reducing police officers' stress levels and getting them ready for the day ahead. Some of you may have seen that in the schools as well, that we found that doing some short meditation activities with some of the children has really helped them kind of bring their stress level down as well. There was a great book that was written by Robert Sapolsky, and it's called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And basically, to simplify it, if you've ever watched a nature show and you've seen, you know, an antelope almost get eaten by a lion or what have you, what you'll notice is that 2 minutes after almost getting eaten by the lion, if you're safe, what's the antelope doing? They're eating grass. Like they're not going to the bar. They're not rocking in a corner. Like they're not actually. It turns out that animals in the wild do not develop post-traumatic stress kind of stress-related ailments. We see that for animals in captivity. You've all probably been to the zoo and you see the poor animals rocking around and they look so distressed. That is not actually the case for animals in the wild. And what was found, if you look at frame-by-frame analyses of animals in the wild, is after they've had a stressful event, they will literally shake from head to toe. And you'll see it, the whole body's trembling. And what is, you know, hypothesized is that what they're doing is they are shedding their stress hormones. So how do we do that ourselves? And how do we process the stress hormones? So last time we talked about the hot walk and talk. We also, sometimes you've probably had this where you laughed, but it was like more nervous laughter. It wasn't actually funny, and you're like, why am I doing that? Well, that's normal. You're processing. Maybe some of us, we cry. Some of us, you know, we could sing. I have a friend who will just do a couple of flight of stairs. All of those things are good ways to connect and kind of, you know, bring us back to kind of our baseline. And those are things we can do privately that nobody needs to see, and they don't take a very, you know, a lot of time. I'll talk next time or in a couple of webinars about connecting with other people and why that can matter so much, but I'm going to save that for now. So if you've never tried mindfulness, there are lots of great apps out there. One of them, and I have no affiliation with them, I'm not endorsing them, I'm just mentioning them. One of them is called Calm, C-A-L-M. Another one is called Headspace. I found that one to be really great. And it's an app that you can download. And these don't need to be 40-minute, you know, meditations where you're sitting on a cushion and your butt hurts. Like, you can do 3-minute ones. They're very easy and very simple. Another one that's been very helpful, of course, has been yoga. Now, what's interesting is yoga was adapted. You'll see here it says yoga for warriors. What we found is that a lot of people in law enforcement and the military kind of didn't like the idea of yoga and mindfulness. If, you know, it sounded too touchy-feely. But when we called it combat breathing and yoga for warriors, all of a sudden it seemed, you know, perfectly good. And there's a whole bunch of ways in which you can do those things in a way that fits with your personal preferences and your body type and your physical fitness level. So not everyone needs to go and become, you know, an ultra-marathon CrossFitter in order to do these things. We just need to bring some small activities into our daily life and try them out. So the reflection activity for this webinar is inviting you to think about, of the different kind of approaches or suggestions or strategies that I recommended, what is one that you could try? What's one activity that already works for you, and what's one activity that, you know, you could experiment with? So as a when I was a crisis worker, I used to be a runner, and I got injured, and now I can't run anymore, which is a sign of aging as well. I used to go on long runs. I was not fast. I was not a particularly good runner. But what I realized is that it just allowed me to kind of shed my day, you know, kind of have everything drop off. Now, when my family commitments became more complicated, I wasn't able to do that anymore. But what I could do is I could, you know, walk from work instead of driving or whatever. So I just kind of needed to find different ways to kind of reset myself, because what didn't work for me was going straight from, you know, the front lines, the trenches, to the chaos of the home. I needed something. So I have a colleague who has a very busy household, and what she said is, what she does is before she walks in the door, she'll just go and sit, when the weather permits, you know, in her yard just for 2 minutes, and just force herself to look around her, notice things in nature, step away from her day job, and then she transitions. So I invite you to think about that. What could you try? And also invite you to consider, try these things more than 2 or 3 times. Give it its good old, you know, good old like 5, 6, 7, 8 times before you decide they're not for you. And I'll provide some more resources also on the website for you to try out. So again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. And I'll see you in the next webinar.